I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
What happens when a classically educated physicist decides to study collective human behavior as it relates to the token economy? Well, you get a unique perspective on politics, technology, and our prospects for the future.
In this episode, we speak with Andrea Broncelli, Associate Professor of Mathematics at the City University of London. Take a listen.
So thank you. My name is Andrea Broncelli. I'm a physicist by background, currently Associate Professor in Mathematics at City University of London, and token economy theme lead at the Alan Turing Institute, where the token economy is a theme I created and ran exactly to study the economy and the society around blockchain. The typical question I get is why a physicist studies problems related to society. I'm not the only one doing that. Physics has developed a series of conceptual and practical technologies in the past decades to study large collection of interacting agents, let's say. So society was always very tempting. And with the digital economy and the internet revolution, now we have data. So we build models and can test the data, can analyze the data. So physicists doing this job are present in the industry, in social networks or big corporations, in Web3 and in academia. And personally, the reason why I went there is that I studied actually classics in high school. I took a very classics-oriented path in Italy and ancient Greek, Latin, etc. And then I was very much undecided between philosophy and physics. I went into physics, but the human element was always very appealing to me. And so then through physics, I kind of went back to society and humans.
So Andrea, what is the token economy in your eyes? What are you talking about when you're talking about the token economy?
So that's, of course, a very good question, and many people will give you different answers. From my point of view, what I'm interested in broadly is how we shape and are shaped by the socio-technical systems we inhabit. So once there is a technology, in this case, the blockchain technology, how do communities and society more broadly adopt it, and how their adoption feedbacks back into the design of the technology itself, and how the technology modifies the norms and the behavior or the activities of the community itself. So by token economy, I, at a very broad level, intend this, which is mapping and trying to understand what's going on around this blockchain technology. There is a huge focus in the space on the design aspect. So always trying to design, but what happens once the technology is out there? More specifically, of course, tokens can be used to incentivize behavior at different levels. And so once we have understood what's going on, we can also imagine to help design better tokens. For example, to induce positive change. Global challenges nowadays, there is a consensus that some sort of collective behavior change is needed. There have been editorials in Science about climate change and in general about antibiotic resistance. There is all these collective action problems where no individual has a real incentive to modify their behavior if everyone else keeps doing the same thing. And so we need incentives to bring society at a tipping point and then adopt the new behavior. Tokens can be very powerful in this sense. Incidentally, by the way, I've studied these dynamics also from the point of view of tipping points in social dynamics, critical mass, and with both models and my PhD, and then experiments with humans, data, etc.
What is the tipping point? What does your experimentation lead you to believe about things like climate change and antibiotic resistance, the things that require concerted collective effort? What is the tipping point?
So our contribution is more theoretical. So in general, we wanted to provide the first empirical evidence in support of the theory of critical mass. Now, what does the theory of critical mass? The theory of critical mass is so popular that everyone more or less has an idea and understanding of what it is. But the theory of critical mass makes a very precise prediction. It says that a minority can actually radically change the behavior of a majority. Typically, we speak about social norms, so behaviors that are normative or conventional. But this happens in this way. So the minority is actually completely ineffective and negligible up to a point in which it reaches a certain size, the critical mass. And at that point, it becomes tremendously effective. So it is not a continuous change. It says, well, if it's 5%, probably you don't do anything. But if you do reach the critical mass, which I don't know, can be 10%, then you actually steer the majority. So I had studied this with the models physicists do. At the same point, while it is used to explain every kind of behavior, alcohol abolitionism and the fight against state legalization of marijuana, same-sex marriage, Arab Springs, and so on and so forth. This is always very anecdotal. So maybe the critical mass might be at work there. So what we did is a very simple online game in which basically there is a population of users, but they only interact in pairs. And they need to give the name to a character, a picture of a woman or a man who will stay there. So pairs interact. And of course, what happens is that you type your own name, and after you are done typing, you reveal the name that your partner gave it. Typically at the beginning there is, you say Sarah and they say Mary, and you just take into account that this is happening and you play with someone else. So maybe you can stick to Sarah, maybe you can say, well, let me try Mary, and someone else will use another name. What happens, and this was a first study, it's that eventually they managed to reach a consensus on a single name. So without any centralized authority, only out of their local interactions, they managed to create a language. Of course, in this case, it's a very prototypical one. And this was an idea by Wittgenstein. Luke Steels tested it. This is a study that I did with my colleague, Damon Santola, who's very good at implementing experiments. Okay, so this is, they agree. Then what's a tipping point? The second study was, okay, let them agree. Once they have agreed, we put a small fraction of confederates of ours pushing for a different name. So they have agreed on Mary, and we put them pushing Alice. The model suggested that when they reach around 25%, the situation should drop. And the nice thing of an experiment like this is that you can really do 5%, 10%, 15%, 20%. And it does happen. So when the minority of confederates reached the tipping point, the whole population flipped, going to another name. And it's important to say, I didn't say it before, that every time you agree on a name in an interaction, the users did a little bit of money. So going through a phase of disagreement is a bit annoying because you lose a little bit of money. However, with 25%, they managed to steer. So of course, this is very synthetic. In a lab, it's simplified. But it gives a first empirical grounding to this idea of critical mass. Now, you can say, how to implement it in the wild? That's not easy at all. And also our threshold of 25%, of course, applies to our setting. So it's very difficult to estimate which would be the threshold in the wild. Theoretically, it's very, very important that it's way below 50%. Because, of course, so it's still clearly a minority.
Wow.
I just had this image of the U.S. elections coming up. You know, I was in the U.S. At the last elections. And for me, as a European, this is like a big bingo board with like flipping colors. You know, sometimes it's more blue, sometimes it's more red. And so anyways, I'm not sure if that has any connections. I guess there is some connections, actually quite a lot.
Andrea, this brings up for me a really profound question about the majority, okay? So it seems like human, from what you're describing, basically agreement continues to change and change and change and change, driven by the minority. In other words, once you have kind of ubiquitous understanding about something, for example, I assume right now we have pretty much ubiquitous understanding about climate change, but not a ubiquitous idea about what to do about it. And maybe that is where this minority action is coming into play. But is there not a place where the majority opinion basically stays the majority opinion? I mean, in other words, are we always mercurial and moving from one side to the other, or is there kind of different kinds of circumstances where the truth is the truth and that's all there is to it?
Hey, this depends a lot also on your philosophical views on whether the truth is the truth. I'm a scientist, of course, so I'm inclined to think that the scientific method actually does, it produces an ever-changing understanding of the world, but there is agreement on the method. And that basically stays since the times of Galileo, when he said the world is a book, nature is a book written in mathematical terms, it kind of stayed there. This said, it depends a lot. For example, the reason why fashion changes is very different from the reason why accepting less freedom in exchange for more security changes. And we observe that historically, on the long term, everything seems doomed to collapse. All the empires, and I'm from Rome, and the Roman Empire is not here anymore. And from what you were mentioning about climate change, we did very recently do a study studying exactly polarization on social media around the debate on climate change in correspondence with COP events. And what we found is that COP26, there was an increase of polarization compared to them. There is always a majority and a minority group, which very loosely are like those who agree with science on the reason, I mean, agree with the scientific position on climate change and the more denials or critical. Of course, in COP26, something, which is the last one, by the way, is the one of Glasgow, and something new has started to kick in heavily, which is what to do about it. We don't observe a growing polarization due to individuals changing their mind between the two groups, but we see a large engagement with the conversation from groups that can be labeled loosely as right wing or far right, especially we focused on English language, so especially in the US and UK, when there is a COP, the debate is always very skewed for the country that is hosting the COP that year. So UK was represented also for this reason. And so this is what happening there. And there is a minority. Of course, the problem of polarization is another stream of my research. I don't have a solution on how to solve it. As a scientist who studied classics, I must say that what we are doing and have been doing as a society, but this is of course an opinion, is being killing the humanities completely from the curriculum. But history and even philosophy or literature would help a lot at a scale.
All right, so consensus shifts based on the minority, and then when the minority reaches a critical point, And it's clear that in order to solve the world's problems, we need a shift toward those solutions. I guess my next question would be, how could tokens help us create that, reach that critical mass?
Again, this is like a gigantic question for the human race. I wish I had the answer. With this, everything would work for sure. Of course, we need incentives. I do think that centralization here is not bad to move in the right direction. That is, it is very important that all governments, ideally, or most governments decide to move in the same direction. Of course, we are moving in a complex social system, socioeconomic system, for which is very, very difficult to imagine the ripples of action. So, for example, moving out of the oil economy. Well, now, of course, the war has changed everything, the war in Ukraine, and so this seems to be destined to happen later than we expected. But of course, the oil corporations are massive in the financial markets. The funds backed by oil own many other funds, and so on and so forth. So a first point is, I think centralization is good for something like that, if governments decide to act together. So it requires a lot of wisdom, because the damage you could do, that would backfire, is huge, in the sense, if you create in 2 years a major financial crisis because of your decisions, then convincing people to stay on track would become hugely problematic. On the positive side, how to move and incentivize creating infrastructure, for example, is absolutely crucial, and once again is centralized. However, the technologies like the blockchain, for example, through DAOs, could be very significant in empowering. So DAOs are decentralized autonomous organizations that are basically organizations based on blockchain, where there is a sort of direct democracy in terms of how to use funds. On a macro scale, I'm a bit skeptical, because direct democracy has shown over and over a series of problems. For example, that those who are rich in time become overly influential, etc. But at the level of the local community and empowering local communities in taking the steps that they judge beneficial to their community, for the environment, concerning, for example, forest management, repopulation of plants, etc. There is clear evidence that when these kind of decisions are decentralized, things tend to work better, both in terms of efficacy of the intervention and in terms of people caring about the actions, and therefore modifying their behavior also in non-directly involved aspects of it. So, when the problems are so huge, I would say that the decentralization maximalism, like saying everything is blockchain, we don't need any centralized power, we do it, is probably a view I don't subscribe to. But an interplay of macro direction taken together and then micro local empowering could, I think, help. But of course, again, this is a huge question, so I don't know.
So I think it's important for us to get back to what you're actually studying, which is the token economy. And maybe you could just give us, kind of go back to my question of, might you have an example of how, for example, a token could incentivize people to use less carbon or to not eat meat? Or like, how does that work? Or is that not in your domain of study?
I mean, there are different ways. There is a negative way for sure, which I think it's a major challenge for our civil rights now happening. So there are central banks' digital currencies, which are being already tested by a bunch of countries and designed for many countries. These are non-public blockchain, of course. They would be handled by central banks or governments. And they are promoted as increasing financial inclusion. But of course, they have spooky possibilities for a government to incentivize behaviors. In a sense, all transactions would be live into the belly of your government, either central bank, government, state. And this money is programmable. So, for example, a candidate mayor for New York City is already saying, well, I mean, when we pay benefit, we could say that that money cannot be spent on alcohol. My opinion of this is terrible. It seems really an erosion of our civil rights. But one could say, okay, but going on this, one could say that there is a red meat consumption can be de-incentivized also through these means. And say, oh, the money you get from tax rebate cannot be spent in things that increment CO2 production, or also you have a bonus to be spent only on things that are green. Do we want this or not? This depends, again, it's unavoidable to go to philosophy. From the point of view of how this could help to incentivize, I don't have a precise example. It's not my study directly. What I can say is for sure, at the level of charities or management of resources for the good, technologies such as blockchain hugely increment the transparency and therefore reliability and trust of the people towards this institution, which for things like this can be significant. And then there is always, there are initiatives like you have tokens proportional to the number of trees you plant, or if you do this activity or that. There is the typical Oracle problem, however, on this, that is, you get a token or you get incentivized by doing something that is off-chain, it's not in the blockchain. So then there needs to be some sort of off-chain way to verify that actually you are doing those actions. And this is a general problem of blockchain-based systems.
Yeah, that makes sense. Although there are smart contracts and as you said, digitally DAOs, what's a DAO again? Decentralized autonomous organizations. I mean, all of that technology enables some kind of verification at some level, right? This, especially smart contracts.
Well, smart contracts have always the problem of the Oracle. I mean, we can do a smart contract that I pay you every time that it's sunny in London. The smart contract guarantees that given the signal that it's sunny in London, I will certainly pay you. However, the Oracle problem is this input cannot be in the smart contract. There need to be a sensor outside.
I see. So it's always some external measurement that's going to verify what's happening digitally. And that makes a lot of sense. But it's still probably more transparent than the way we do it now. So it's clear that we can probably design tokens to try to incentivize or disincentivize almost any human behavior. And I guess the next question is, how do we ensure the adoption of those tokens? I mean, is that also a matter of critical mass, or is that, designing money itself requires that you have a fairly strong list of unmet needs and underutilized resources so that you can map what people need with what people have against each other so you can create trade. Is that the same on any other token? And how do you make sure that people will adopt a token?
You know, that's a wonderful question. It's exactly the problem. So in the space, it has been full of project that says, this is my token, it has these properties, this is the blockchain, it's the greener blockchain. Once everyone will have adopted this token, the world will be in a better place. And of course, nobody adopts that token. So the problem of adoption is huge. From the point of view of cryptocurrencies, of course, you have what the economists call network effects. That is, the more people adopt that currency, the better it is. The reason why we are happy to be paid in pounds in the UK, euros in Europe, is that we know that, I mean, our employer gives us the pounds and then we go to the shop and we can buy cheese with the same pounds. So it's the fact that this is a widespread, that there is a widespread adoption. What is slightly different is NFTs. So NFTs can thrive if they find the right community, also arbitrarily small, especially NFTs for collectors. Imagine NFTs for collectors. So you are happy, even before the blockchain, collecting stamps. If you have a decent number of friends collecting stamps, you are not interested in everyone collecting stamps. But how to get, so How to get to the adoption? It's a wildly debated question, both in the industry and in the literature. You have several things. So there is the first mover advantage. The first mover advantage is Bitcoin was the first one, so many stick to it. Litecoin is probably preferable than to Bitcoin because it's just faster in approval. However, it's hugely smaller. Ethereum had the advantage of being the first to implement smart contracts, so a superiority in technology. And cryptocurrencies have been using NFTs to promote themselves. So the question here becomes, will there be eventually only one cryptocurrency, or will a bunch of them survive, or will a myriad of them survive? Probably a bunch of them will survive due to technological differences. It's my bet. For sure, the challenge here, even in terms of incentivizing behavior, is that large corporations are in a position to launch their own currency. So there was Libra, if you remember, designed by Facebook in a consortium with Vodafone, PayPal, Uber, Lyft, etc. And that was basically politically stopped because it would have worked. So imagine a coin immediately available to 2 billion people in their WhatsApp, baked by these corporations. At this point, and there is an interesting document of the Central Bank of Canada that actually says that one reason to speed up on central bank digital currencies is that otherwise they will do that, and then governments cannot have a monetary policy anymore.
You mentioned how these tokens are programmable, right? And so there is an opportunity to bake in to those tools kind of a moral code, or I don't know if you want to call it that, but some core principles of goodness, right? Or or collective good. And to what extent do you think that's already happening?
Well, the real possibility will be with central bank digital currencies. The possibility of embedding a moral code in a currency sounds very scary to me, because it depends what's the moral code. So while at the level of maybe a sister currency, a sister token for a local community, this can be very nice. I mean, it can also go badly, but in general, you can imagine that the community could use it actually for micromanaging effectively their own resources. At the level of a currency in the hands of everybody, I would be very much in favor of basically prohibiting that by law, because in the moment, so it's a radical transformation of our information exchange with the state. So far the state wants to know the money we make because we pay taxes, but doesn't want to know how we spend the money. Now you can say, okay, but you use the credit card. First of all, you cannot use the credit card. And second, in any case, the credit card is in the hands of a company. So there is a step that is typically a judiciary power that has to inform you that they will ask about the thing. From this state, we would move in a state in which in the hands of the centralized power of the state, there is also how you spend the money. And this is, if we think about Snowden, we can imagine that even in democratic countries, the temptation of using this information in several ways could be strong and probably not desirable. On top of that, you can program even. Now, of course, the rhetoric and also the reality is that at the beginning, the central bank digital currency will not substitute cash. So it will be just an extra tool. But if we have seen anything in this last 10 years, not to say 20 years maybe, is that the acceleration toward the digital realm is very, very strong. Today in the cities I know better, which are London, Rome, many bars already don't accept cash anymore. And this can only go farther in this direction. So the programmability, while very appealing, because one could do good, is also very scary because one could do bad or use that as a mean of control.
So basically what you mean is a cashless society turns into a completely 100% controllable society.
Potentially, yes. Potentially, all your transactions are, more than potentially, your transaction, if it's not designed properly, the system is not designed properly, are in a hard disk somewhere. And one can access them when you decide to run for prime minister and say, yeah, but when you were 18, you bought this. Yeah. And there is a comment now we have written with two colleagues in economics, Alex Teitelbaum and Anna Laburde from Oxford and NYU. I think the stunning bit of the story of central bank digital currencies is that huge decisions have been taken right now by the states, literally right now, all central banks. And there is absolutely zero public debate and even zero debate in parliaments. I mean, this is completely outside of the radar, while we would be in a position to help shape what we want out of that system, which is not a technical decision. Is this should happen, this shouldn't happen. On the other end, once they are implemented, there will be a huge friction. So changing it will be much more costly in terms of time, frictions, and complexities. Mm-hmm. And what my dream here would be for a public debate to exist, or at least a parliamentary debate to exist on this.
Do you think it doesn't exist because people think, oh, digital currency, I don't understand it, so I can't have an opinion? Or do you think it's actually by design that it's not being debated?
It is very complex. No, I don't think it's by disattention of the press. And by design, in the sense, I don't see governments saying we should talk about this. So for sure, there is not a push from above towards a debate. Then there is a disattention, and then the topic is very complex. Now, one could say, however, even the topic of nuclear power is very complex. However, there you can simplify it saying, do you want to die or do you want cheap energy? And let's have a nonsensical debate. And on this would be subtler. But as far as I know, the parliaments I control more are not even too much involved into this, which is a bit spooky.
I think we can agree on that. Well, you know, normally we ask at the end of an interview sort of if there is a vision for the future, or if there is a sentence, you know, which comes from the heart from you. And this time, I think in your case, I think I'd rather look back. So imagine you're 90 and you're looking back on your life. What is the biggest change you think you will see in, or you have seen in your lifetime, looking back at your life in your domain?
Well, in my domain, the biggest change has been the availability of data, of digital data about society. So when I started doing my PhD end of 2003, I was one of those physicists doing the nice physics model and saying, it would be very nice to have some data. And now we have too many data. They are dirty, often not very helpful. And this is very important from the point of view of research. We are understanding better many things. We are digital data, even in things like controlling a pandemic, are absolutely crucial. And of course, the dark side is that they expose our behavior to a transparency that we probably don't want, and that empower public or private institutions a lot. But in any case, yeah, the data revolution for sure.
Pri, one of the most widest discussions we ever had on the podcast.
But coolest. I really love it.
Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Raising a lot of really big questions.
But also,
and each question is a podcast episode.
No, but also, you know, coming back to very basic solutions, like kind of leveling the taxes, having complementary currencies, not replacement currencies.
Right.
You know, centralized, yes, but also decentralized at a local level. You know, these are kind of the things that we hope we can manifest, on this podcast.
Clearly he has a classical education. I really appreciated that he brought in the philosophical aspects. I enjoyed it. Sometimes I was completely confused with you two, but otherwise, really good.
And same here.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Brought to you by Game Changers, www.gamechangers.world. For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.